Chinyambuyu.
For instance, for me, as I was joining campus, I was so eager to get into a relationship.
Yeah. All of us.
Into a difference in experience.
It's really easy if you didn't have education about what really happens in campus.
In as much as we want to be quiet about this, this is something that should also be incorporated.
I invite you to be vulnerable. I invite you to be open. I invite you to share your insights and experiences.
Chinyambuyu.
So hello everybody, welcome to another episode of Chinyambuyu Podcast. Today I have four lovely young women in the studio. We are going to talk about their contextual access to SRHR in their culture, in their school, in their communities. So in this episode, it's part of the Campus Cafe series. We're just trying to understand from different regions of the country and different communities what the access to SRHR is and how we as young women advocates, young feminists, in the CSO space, how we can improve that space. So, karibuni, ladies.
Karibuni. Asante.
Thank you.
Maybe we can go around and you can just share what you love most about yourself.
So, if I could start, what I love most about myself is my confidence. I think I'm really confident. And I also love the willpower that I have. I really believe in myself most times. Of course, there are those times that you have those moments, yeah? But most of the times, I think I believe in myself and I believe that I can do anything and everything. So that's one thing I love about myself.
For me, I think what I love about myself most is how I keep on amazing myself. Sometimes I feel like maybe I can't do something, but at the end of the day, I end up doing things that are greater than I think I can. So it's how much I amaze myself, honestly.
That's really nice.
I love my smile the most.
It is a pretty smile.
It has gotten me places.
Hey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, actually, I have a crown and a sashi because of my smiles.
Hey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love that, and I also love my zeal.
Okay. Interesting, you know, when she talked about her smile, my smile is like the defense. Sometimes I struggle with confidence, then I just smile. Someone asks me something, then it distracts them. So I use it as a defense mechanism. Aww. But what I really love about myself is growth. Like, I can say I'm the peak. I admire these young ladies, like, a lot. Like, since I stepped into law school. But now that I'm in this platform and I see myself grow every single day, like, from experiences, is what really I do love about myself.
Thank you. I mean, I can share. For me, I love my adaptability. I love that I can get into any space and I can grow, I can learn, and I can thrive in different spaces. So thank you for sharing. Now, getting into the conversation that we're having today about sexual reproductive health and rights access in terms of information and services in the different contexts that you're in. So I'd like to ask you, in your communities, is information about sexual reproductive health and rights, is that accessible to you?
So I think for me, I come from the South Rift region of the country, and I can say information is still a problem. Let me give a case example where there was a time where the dispensary in my local home was actually planning, giving out advice on family planning, the methods people can use and all that. And many women tried to go, and the problem even was not that they're being prevented. It's just that you're seen in the clinic, people start discussing about you. So you even find that other fellow women are bashing you against it. And you do find that, of course, what heartbreaks me the most is almost each and every other household has someone who has had a teenage pregnancy, and sometimes there are things that can be prevented. And so at the end of the day, the access to informations, to information, access to even the reproductive health care, family planning itself is a problem, and it's more of a societal problem rather than even that condoms are not there. Condoms sometimes are actually there. The family planning methods, doctors are willing to do that, but it's more of, in my place, it's more of a society issue where people are not ready to still have these conversations. Yes.
It's funny when you talk about when people are seen in these dispensaries and there's a certain stereotype that's attached to it. It reminds me of a story a friend of mine once told me when she was going to get what are they called? These kits, testing kits for pregnancy, yeah? She told me when she approached the chemist, she had to pretend that she was making a phone call to take the kit to someone else. So she was like, hello, naleta size. And then now she ordered. Because you see, there's so much shame around these things. Because you're like, if I tell this person that I want to purchase this kit, what would they think, you know, about me? Yeah. So really, I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
So before we get there, can I ask you, you've shared that you have a dispensary in your home that provides SRHR services. Mm-hmm. Can you please tell me what that is, what kind of services they are? Mm-hmm.
So especially on matters of family planning, from the advice to also the pills, in case you want, for example, the family planning methods of insertions, whether it's IUD and all that, they can refer you to the hospital. But things like pills, especially condoms, are there, all that. So those are the most I have seen that are provided.
Okay, so I come from Nyanza region, and I know a lot about my constituency because I've been working in the community service space in such a long time. So there are certain places in my constituency where SRHR services are available, and there are areas where you can barely get them.
Mm-hmm. I think
it's only
disparity.
I think it's in terms of development, because in my constituency there are towns. There are like two towns, and then the rest are villages. So we can get them in towns, but then the villages, no. Yeah, even when it comes to menstrual products, there's a lot of period poverty in the villages. We've had so many cases of girls having to sleep with men just to get money to buy things like pads. So yeah, and when it comes to other SRHR services like contraceptives and all that, there are areas in my constituency where so many teenagers are getting contraceptives. And there's a time we had to like tackle it as an issue, because in as much as they do have autonomy over their bodies, at the end of the day they're still minors. So we had to like go there and try and understand. It's the area is around, we have a river in our constituency, so it's like a beach. So we have like fishermen and all that. So most of the girls over there are using contraceptives. Contraceptives that last up to 10 years and all of that. So we've had the conversation on whether to allow adolescents to get these contraceptives or whether to preach abstinence. Because still, the number of teen pregnancies in my
is very high.
It's crazy.
Because that's the next question. That's the thing I wanted to ask you, because you brought out that minors are getting contraceptives. We know that from 2020 COVID year, when COVID just shut down the whole country, and girls were forced to stay home. And then last year they did a KDHS survey, and they found that there's a lot of like teenage pregnancies in Kenya are very high. So, and you've shared that in your constituency, that is also very high. So what do you think would be the right way to go about reducing that? Because you'd see if a girl gets pregnant and she's in high school, then she either drops out of school, she faces stigma from the community, she faces low self-esteem. So what would you say would be the right way to sort of curb that teenage pregnancy issue?
Okay, so I work with an organization in my constituency, and it's women-led. So this organization began in 2020, when there was a huge surge in the number of teen pregnancies in my constituency. And all the students were home, they were being preyed on, and the reports were crazy. We had like thousands. We're talking about thousands in my constituency. So that's when we formed the organization, and we began a zero teen pregnancy campaign, and we visited all wards in my constituency, and we used to target over 1,000 girls per ward. So after doing that for about 6 months. We worked on it for 6 months. So we had no rest. It was just case to case. Trying to assemble these girls, trying to tell them the dangers of teen pregnancies, and then being symbols of empowerment in our own right, because then they get to see young, successful women who are not pregnant and who are abstaining and all that. So it worked.
Mm-hmm.
In short, it worked. And in 2021, the numbers went down.
Mm-hmm.
So the best method is going to getting these girls and mentoring them and preaching abstinence and getting this information to them. Because information, lack of information is actually a real thing. And this is where it all stems from.
Sorry, I'm so sorry. I just want to sort of extrapolate this conversation on teenage pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
For you, you've also shared the challenges in terms of stigma in accessing SRHR and also drawing from your experiences, especially during COVID. Did you guys go home from school?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So in your own context, in your own families, in your own communities, seeing that, I think we all share the same experience of, because I also share that when I went home, so many girls in high school got pregnant, literally, and they were not able to go back to school.
Mm-hmm.
So that being one of the biggest challenges that has been highlighted by the KDHS survey, what do you think is the right measure to curbing teenage pregnancy and ensuring that girls stay in school?
Well, if I could go first, I really think that the key is information, number one. Information is a necessary tool to actually curb this, because I really think that, you know, we have to understand that these are people who are growing. If I could just throw a spanner to the works, I think all of us here take law, those of us who are guests to the podcast today, and we learn something in our children's law class. We learn something about the developmental stage of adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
That as they grow up and they get to that stage, they are in a stage of exploration. Yeah, so they want to explore. They have all these type of feelings they have in their bodies. They want to explore. So how do you give them the right tools as they explore this side of their lives?
Mm-hmm.
The best way to do that is to give them the right information. The other thing I think is, there's poverty, there's a lot of poverty. And the reason why most of teenagers and young girls don't get the right contraceptives or all these birth control methods is because they don't have the money to purchase it. So if there's a way we can kill poverty or have organizations that can actually give these things to these people, then that is the best way forward. But the ultimate tool is to actually try and change their mindset about these things, to try and show them the future that lies ahead is greater and bigger than the short-term, you know, joys of having sexual experiences. So really, it's a balance of everything, yeah? But I think information is the best thing. And, of course, mentoring the girls.
Also, I think all this curiosity can be killed when we actually have conversations.
Yes.
For sure.
Because
for sure.
They go out exploring because they don't really know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have people who are experienced, go to them and talk to them about issues like sex openly, then it kills the curiosity to some level.
I want to throw a spanner in the works. You guys are... You're looking it from the girl's side.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're curious. They want to learn about sex.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, some of them are sexually assaulted.
Yes.
So, yes, some of them are...
Mm-hmm.
Some of them do that so that they can have food or even buy pads.
Yeah.
So also looking from that angle of maybe this is sexual violence.
Mm-hmm.
This is rape. This is statutory rape. I'm not a lawyer.
Yes. It's statutory. Yes.
Yeah. So looking from that angle in terms of getting solutions from also the angle of maybe it could be sexual violence.
Mm.
How also can we sort of end that? You can answer.
Yeah. When, for example, what we're doing here and what my colleague has mentioned about creating safe spaces and running organizations that empower these women, because I remember this because the COVID report that was prepared, I was among the adolescent boys who was asked to come and present after the report had been compiled. And what these doctors, Dr. Githinji, for example, was saying is, we don't wait until the problem escalates. What can we do in order to
arrest the issue?
Yes, from the source, like from the core. We don't wait for an outburst or an outbreak. And I think what's important is if we have women-led organizations that create like a really, you know, when you're in a community and you've never heard about an organization that can really understand what you're going through or what you can share your story or you can find help as a young adolescent girl in that community. I think it's very important because it gives you the confidence to wake up in the morning and not go and stay with this man, but run mm-hmm. to this organization, seek help. And having more NGOs and organizations that really champions for these rights is so important. And it starts with all of us over here who've mm-hmm. had like the little information we've been talking about to take it back home to the villages. Mm-hmm. Because even my community, like banditry is an issue. So focusing on girls' issues is like an issue because people are trying mm-hmm. to solve like the big issues. Mm-hmm. So now how do we sit down and focus on this young woman and young girl? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's still an ongoing issue.
Mm-hmm. And I think we are always very careful in terms of dealing with ensuring that we don't victimize the victims. When you see young girls who have been assaulted, a larger percentage is a cousin, an uncle, their father. Mm-hmm. And honestly, coming across these cases, you always feel like just killing this person right in front of you. How do you assault your daughter? Yeah. This, and you find that these assaults are not... We are even talking about girls as young as 4 years mm-hmm. who have been assaulted by these people. And they might not get pregnant, but at the end of the day, those are their lives being destroyed. And when it comes to especially assault, people are not ready to report these cases. We can't lie. Mm-hmm. If an uncle assaults you, that's something that's shelved and dealt with family.
Why do you think there's the lack of reporting? Because I think I was having a conversation with someone from Samburu and they were saying that you will find that they will rank high in FGM, but they'll rank low in GBV. So people don't want to report cases of GBV. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's a mismatch in reporting. So people are shying away from reporting these incidences. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
I think people are shy from reporting these incidences because most of the time we want to cover up for these people. Remember mm-hmm. that the people who are assaulting you are your neighbors, people you see eye to eye every day. You, let's say, for example, some others, you'll tell them that my cousin has assaulted me. Mm-hmm. And you see, at the end of the day, their first reaction is, let me call their mother. We sort this thing out. Yeah. It's more about we are always trying to protect perpetrators in our society because they are close people to us. Mm-hmm. And it becomes now a problem in the fact that you protect this time and next time he goes and assaults someone else. Yeah. People are not seeing that vicious circle that when someone especially is a perpetrator, when someone is a rapist, they will go again and do that to someone else. And sometimes actually arresting might be protecting this person against society. And so it's so sad that the fact that as a community, you're trying to protect your own people, yet your own people are the ones who are causing harm to this society. When you get the fact that many girls actually get pregnant, yes, they'll go get checked, give birth and all that. I think also what's happening is this thing is constantly being encouraged also in the fact that you see that it was so sad, and this is funny, my cousins actually, the elder sister got pregnant and the younger one went and got pregnant too. And you see, you can't understand how these things work, but you feel that we are not giving them information, they're giving themselves peer pressure. That happens that way. They're giving themselves peer pressure to do these things. And one proud thing I have to say about some of my friends, there's this organization called the Second Chance Initiative. It's currently both especially in the Kericho County and hopefully soon in Bomet. They're trying to also ensure that these people who are victims are not victimized and they actually have the space to create also new opportunities for themselves, go back to school. Sometimes it's just requesting a mother just take care of your daughter's child so that they can go back to school. So that's how we are trying to also lessen the victimizations of the victims. Mm-hmm. Yes.
If I could add my voice to sexual violence, mm-hmm. I think there's so many actors that come into play in terms of trying to eradicate and react to sexual violence. I'm thinking about the community themselves, I'm thinking about the parents, but I'm also thinking about the criminals, the justice system itself. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really, when we think about police officers, are they really doing enough? Yeah, when someone goes to report a matter to the police station, do they make an effort to actually arrest these persons? And when they get arrested, are they able to ensure that these persons face the charges and all these things? Because you'll find out that most families will collude with police officers mm-hmm. and have these perpetrators go back home. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So these are the things that affect our society today. So if everyone could actually play their part right, mm-hmm. then we'll hack this. But until people realize that they have a role that they need to play, then we'll be here for a very long time. And maybe one last thing about, maybe we've talked about girls being, you know, sexually violated. Let's talk about boys. The many boys who get violated, the, you know, there's sexual violence around young boys and men. The thing with boys, obviously the thing with the male species is the ego aspect. They don't want to seem like someone took advantage of them. And the conditioning in our culture, the conditioning in our society is really making people suffer day in, day out. So I think the other reason why people don't report these things, especially with regards to male violence, is the aspect of shame and, you know, the ego factor. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're just not angry enough. I believe in positive anger. As Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie says in her book, we should all be feminists. Positive anger has led to so much change in the world. Positive anger is what made us, as a country, get rid of FGM. Where everyone was like, we are done.
For sure.
We cannot keep on losing girls because of this. It has to stop. And we had all stakeholders coming. We had the community. We had politicians speaking ill about it. We even have the president, you know, constantly telling people that FGM has to end. We have to just agree. As a community, as a, in
as
our
a
own
communities,
as a nation, to stop teenage pregnancies.
I agree.
We have to be angry enough. I mean, there's a time I was working for an organization and we visited another constituency. And as we were talking to the girls, we heard of a story of a guy who's impregnated 10 teenagers in that community. And I was like, what do you mean?
What are you doing?
And they all know him. In fact, he's termed as the rapist of the area. But then he's protect. People are just, people get ignorant. They're like, the parents are like, sim toto angu, so, you know. So my stand on sexual violence and teen pregnancy, because sleeping with a minor is a crime in Kenya.
That's a crime. How many years is, according to the law, what's the punishment for sleeping with minors or for defiling? Because that's defilement, right?
Yeah, what's the punishment for defilement?
It depends on the age. I could just get the right numbers, if you don't mind.
So everyone who sleeps with a minor is supposed to be arrested, in short. And if we can walk into all these hospitals and get records of teen pregnancies, we should also get records of the men who impregnated these girls. And these men should face the law. Because then why are we always like looking at the victims? Why are we always sympathizing with teen pregnant teen moms?
Instead of going for the perpetrators.
We are never talking about perpetrators and what we should do to them. So, yeah.
You have a number?
Yeah. So, under the Sexual Offences Act, Section 8, so it breaks it down depending on the age. So, if a child under the age of 11 is defiled, then the perpetrator is to be sentenced for life. If a child between the ages of 12 and 15 is defiled, then the conviction is an imprisonment of a term of not less than 20 years. If a child is defiled between the ages of 16 and 18, then the imprisonment is for a term not less than 15 years. So it really spans from 15 to life.
To life.
Whatever is in the act or whatever is in the statutes is really dependent on how the court will decide. So again, that's why I said every actor needs to play their part right. There's some magistrates who will convict people for even 6 years and they've defiled someone who's really young. You know, it's really absurd because that's wrong. That's so wrong. And such people need to be trained. They need to know that, hey, if the law says ABCD, of course, the judges usually have, they're able to look at the case and determine there are certain mitigating factors. So, for example, if someone is a first-time offender, maybe the penalty will be less. But some of these things, such as defilement, especially for these children, it should not be less than 15 years. So really, every actor must play
play their part
to ending this. And we should not be ignorant to the fact that teenagers are also having sex amongst themselves. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So also that's an issue that should be looked at. And most of the time you find that these are children defiling themselves. So we always go to a point where you're going after the boy only. Yeah. And yet also the girl.
It's also that both can claim status.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so at the end of the day, there's also a way in which you should look at the justice system in such a manner that sometimes these are just children who are exploring. So how can they be redirected from the justice system of going to prison and all that, to be redirected, to be guided in such a manner that they are able also to just go beyond their mistakes of exploration? Okay. Yeah.
That's why we have the system called diversion.
Yeah.
So when such things happen, the best way possible is to divert this case from the criminal so they don't go through the process of going to court. Mm. You take them outside court and try and solve this dispute outside the court.
Yes.
Okay. So thank you, ladies, for sharing your insights on sexual violence and teenage pregnancy and also bringing in a fresh legal aspect. Mm-hmm. I think now I'd say I have, and maybe the audience have, a more understanding according to about the punishment or and also reporting for sexual violence.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for your insights and thank you for being open and having this conversation.
Right.
Thank you so much.
The views that have been shared here are expressly our own views and they do not reflect the views of Akili Dada or any other affiliate organizations.